It's Central Time. I'm Darrell Connor.
I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, some dairy farmers in western Wisconsin have been traveling to the homes of their workers in Mexico to learn more about their families and their lives. We'll hear from the group that's making it all happen.
But first, it's time to look at some of the top stories in national politics.
Passage of the far-reaching farm bill looks likely after it cleared the Senate yesterday. A criminal justice reform bill is also getting brought up for a vote before the holidays. And President Trump sparred yesterday with Democratic leaders in the Oval Office over whether a government funding bill should include money for a border wall.
Our question for you this week: do you think President Trump is right to force a partial government shutdown if Congress doesn't approve border wall funding? Should building a wall be part of border security now or in the long term? And if a shutdown does happen, which party would you see as responsible? Does a shutdown matter to you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org.
Daniel Neuhauser is a staff correspondent for the National Journal. He joins us from the U.S. Capitol building. Dan, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Let's start with this kind of weird meeting. President Trump, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, and Nancy Pelosi, probably the next House Speaker, had this kind of rowdy meeting in the Oval Office about government funding. Let's give a little listen and get a taste of what happened yesterday.
20 times Chuck, you have called for, I will shut down the government if I don't get my wool. None of us have
said. You want to know something?
You've said
okay,
it.
Okay, you want to put that
you've
on my...
You said it.
I'll take it.
Okay, good.
You know what I'll say? Yes. If we don't get what we want, one way or the other, whether it's through you, through a military, through anything you want to call, I will shut down the government.
Okay,
absolutely. And I am proud, and I'll tell you what, I am proud to shut down the government for border security, Chuck, because the people of this country don't want criminals and people that have lots of problems and drugs pouring into our country. So I will take the mantle.
All right, a lot going on here, Dan. First of all, the meeting itself, I don't know that it was intended to have this kind of feud on camera. What do you make of this?
Well, I mean, this reminded me more of like a contentious Thanksgiving family dinner than a meeting between political adversaries. It was rowdy, as you said. It was consisted of a lot of bickering and frankly, circus-like.
And this moment here where President Trump says, it couldn't have stated it more clearly, if a shutdown happens over the border wall, he will take responsibility. How are Republicans on the Hill reacting to that? Are they keen to have a Republican-branded shutdown?
Well, absolutely not. There's been several of these shutdowns or near shutdowns over the last decade or so, and it's always kind of a finger-pointing game where maybe there's a little bit of blame on both sides because the fact is they can't come to terms on a certain policy, but nobody generally tries to come out and say, I'm shutting this government down, and it's my fault, blame me, and I'm doing it because of this. They always try to say, I don't want to shut the government down, but if you don't agree to my policy, it's going to be your fault. President Trump just kind of gave away the game there, and I've been talking to a couple of members up here, and they're not exactly happy about that. They'd love to be able to sell this a different way.
Now, we have some government funding, some portions of the government funding bills due not too far from now, just over a week. What is at stake here? What are the sides saying? What's the president looking for border wall? What are Democrats offering on border security? Different words.
Yes. So the key here is it a wall or is it some sort of security fence or security infrastructure? President Trump is sticking with his campaign promise of saying, I need a wall, and he's asking for $5 billion in this Department of Homeland Security funding bill to construct a wall. Now, in the past, they've gone back and forth about this, and they've tried to tie it to the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrival, or better known as the DREAMer program. And Senate Democrats went so far as to even offer $25 billion over 10 years for a wall or security fence or something of the sort in exchange for a long-term fix to the DREAMer issue. And that did not fly with the White House. So now they've okayed basically $1.6 billion max for not what they're calling a wall, but more of a fence. But now the dynamic has kind of changed since the House is poised to flip sides to the Democrats next year. Democrats are buoyed by the fact that they're going to be in control. They have a lot of progressive members coming in here who are not interested in even $1.6 billion for this. So what Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer have now agreed to cast as their position is that they want a one-year continuing resolution, which would just continue current policy, which includes, say, about $1.3 billion for border security until next year, and then they would resume these discussions towards the end of next year and try to get more of a long-term fix in there.
We're looking at some of the top stories in national politics. Dan Neuhauser is with us from the National Journal. Do you have thoughts on this standoff over border security funding, border wall funding? Do you want to see a literal wall, as the president is calling for, should Congress vote to pay for it? Or do you want to see a smaller amount of border security funding added or not at all? And is this all worth shutting down part of the federal government for? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. For now, Dan, I want to move on to an issue that I know you're following, the U.S. Farm Bill. We've talked about this on the show before. It does a lot. This is food aid. This is farm subsidies and a lot more besides. Where are we now on this wide-ranging effort to pass this thing?
Well, they are literally taking the final vote on the House floor as we speak. So we will maybe by the end of the time that we're on the phone here talking know a little more about whether or not this will pass. But it seems poised to pass as I checked the vote totals on the way in to do this interview with you. It seemed well on its way, so it looks like everything is going to be on its way to the president's desk before the end of the day.
Now, did I see, I think you were tweeting on this, this is a farm bill, this is all about U.S. agriculture, and somehow funding for Saudi Arabia related to the war in Yemen has become an issue in it?
Absolutely right. So there was some pretty high drama earlier today. So before they pass any bill, they have to pass what's called a rule, which basically contains all the rules for how to debate this bill. And last night, Republicans put into that rule some language that would block the ability of members to bring up a privileged resolution to try to end funding for Saudi Arabia while it's engaged in its conflict in Yemen. Then members were not happy about that when they found out this morning. And there was a bipartisan contingent, almost every Democrat, all but five, voted against that so-called rule. And several Republicans did too. And it would have failed, which would have meant back to the drawing board for how to get the farm bill to the floor, if not for five Democrats who are largely sympathetic to the farm bill, who crossed party lines and voted for the rule. But this only blocks the Yemen debate for the rest of the year. Next year, it's January 3rd when they come back in. They can start all over. And I already talked to Ro Khanna, who has been the chief sponsor of this Yemen resolution. He said they're gonna get right back to it as soon as possible.
Okay, getting to the non-Yemen parts of the U.S. Farm Bill, what were some of the key compromises that were made? Because there were a lot of sticking points. What were some of the key compromises that got this thing on the road to passage?
Well, I wouldn't call them compromises so much as House Republicans pretty much completely giving up on some of their more contentious efforts. They were, the biggest sticking point was that they were trying to put work requirements on people who are in the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, also known as food stamps. That was completely removed from the bill. There's hardly anything dealing with that anymore. And then Senator Chuck Grassley was trying to put limits on farm payments, that they can't be paid also to cousins, nieces, nephews of farm owners, that kinds of things. That was completely removed, too. Grassley ended up voting against the bill in the Senate, but it moved on anyway.
We're talking to Dan Neuhauser of the National Journal about the week's top news in national politics.
Still time for you to weigh in on our question of the week at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see President Trump compromise on the issue of border wall funding in order to avoid a government shutdown? Is this potential shutdown a big deal for you? Do you see one party standing in the way of progress on immigration issues, or is this a bipartisan problem? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Darrell Conner.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue our talk with Dan Neuhauser from the National Journal, looking at some of the week's top stories in national politics. To your calls now, we invited your calls on a border wall and this weird meeting between the president and Democratic leaders in Congress. Peg is with us in Madison. Peg, hi.
Hello.
What do you want to bring up, Peg?
I just have a rhetorical question. And I listen to this president time after time after time during the campaign say that Mexico will pay for the wall. Believe me, believe me. And after 3,000 plus lies from this president, I think everyone should call every single senator and say, get the money from Mexico. That's what you promised.
Peg, thanks for the call. Dan, and Mexico is going to pay for it, part of the wall promise. Has President Trump referred to that in recent memory?
Well, I haven't heard it recently, but I know for sure Democrats have. It is not lost on them that he is asking for taxpayer money to fund something that he said in the campaign would be funded by a foreign country. And so that's just another message in their arsenal when they try to push back against this.
Peg, thanks for that call. We'll go now to Thomas with us in La Crosse. Thomas, hi.
Howdy. I'm actually from down in Texas. I lived down there for quite a while. That's actually where I'm from. But as far as what border security goes, you kind of, like a lot of people sit there and neglect to think that, yeah, we have all this ability. It's no different than you got a door. You have a door to go into your house. So obviously, you have a door so people can't get into your house also when you don't want them to. So kind of the same extent. So that's all I really have to say.
All right, Thomas, thanks for calling in and sharing your thoughts on immigration security. Yeah, and Dan, as we listen to the president and Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer talk about this, they're really coming from different places. The president is saying the wall, a literal wall, is essential to border security. Democrats saying border security can look like a lot of things other than a wall.
Yeah, and a lot of that is that they're beholden to their own political bases. Democrats cannot approve anything that is called a wall, even if they put up some sort of fencing or, have drones patrolling the border or send more agents down there. The wall is the thing that they cannot approve. On the other side of the aisle, Republicans can hardly settle for anything less than a wall. This is such a politicized issue at this moment in time, and it's just hard to see where there's going to be anything like a compromise here.
You know, a big story that we're not really going to focus on, Dan, is the chief of staff, the president's chief of staff, on the way out at the White House. Unclear who he's going to be replaced by, but, you know, the chief of staff is somebody who can go to Congress and try to work out these compromises. Is this uncertainty going to be a problem for President Trump in trying to get things done?
I mean, it may well be. He certainly has other people working underneath the chief of staff level who can come over here and communicate his message. But without that top organizational structure, that's going to make it tough. And that's got to be, I would think, one of the reasons why now there's stories coming out saying that John Kelly is actually going to stay through the new year, maybe longer, as they try to search for somebody else who, as you noted, there still does not seem to be any real idea of who's going to take that job.
Let's take one more call before we move on from the immigration issue. Tim is with us in Spring Green. Hi, Tim.
Hey, I just wanted to say that I think this is it's smoke and mirrors. It's a complete waste of money. It was just a political stunt to begin with. Trump has not demonstrated that this would actually accomplish anything. And what we need is comprehensive immigration reform, not something that's going to destroy habitat and cost billions of dollars.
Tim, thanks for the call. Dan, can the president, has the president walled himself in some ways on the wall issue with such a prominent campaign promise?
I mean, yes, absolutely. As I said before, he needs to keep pushing for this. This is one of the biggest campaign promises, and it animates his base, and it seemed as if the immigration messaging actually worked in a lot of Senate campaigns, although not so much in the House, where they lost 40 seats. So they need to do it, and I guess lost in a lot of that is actually would this work? What is the efficacy of this? And I think it's if you would like to look at something that might illustrate that, members who are on the border, who represent the districts where the wall would actually be, most of them, if not all of them, are against this. They don't want that in their districts.
Thanks for your calls. Dan Neuhauser is with us from the National Journal talking about some of the top stories in national politics. Want to turn to something you wrote about, Dan. Changes happening within the Democratic caucus lower than the level of electing a House Speaker. You looked at some of the new people promoted to the leadership team among congressional Democrats as they get ready to take power here. What are we seeing?
Yeah, that's right. And let me just add, the farm bill passed 369 to 47, so that's completely baked. That just happened. So yes, I wrote about the three members of the DSCC, which is the messaging wing, basically. The DPCC, the messaging wing of the House Democratic Party, and they all got promoted. Hakeem Jeffries is going to be the caucus chair. Sherry Bustos, the chair of the DCCC, which deals with campaigns, and David Cicilline is doing a sort of overchair role, overseeing the other chairs of the DPCC. Not only would I look heavily to these three and a couple of other younger members as the natural heirs to Nancy Pelosi, so people should get really familiar with their names, but also this illustrates to me what's going to be on the agenda for the next year or two for House Democrats. The message that they crafted was for the people. The three items under that umbrella are lower health care costs and prescription costs, to work on an infrastructure bill that would create jobs, and then sort of a sweeping end corruption bill, which deals with expanding voting rights and campaign finance reform. So those are the three things that I would expect the Democrats to hammer again and again, and especially you're going to hear that phrase, for the people, a lot.
And two of those three things you just mentioned, and I think you mentioned this in your piece, lowering prescription costs, for example, and infrastructure, those are both things that President Trump has talked about on the campaign trail and since becoming president, not so much the campaign finance and corruption side of things. But do you see this as maybe, hey, even though we're arguing in the Oval Office, here are some things we can work together on?
Yeah, well, and also on the third one, how many times have you heard the president say drain the swamp? So he is talking about ending corruption, even if he's not exactly doing it. So it's absolutely not a coincidence that these three items are things that seem to come right out of the president's mouth. The people who are involved in crafting this tell me, you know, if the president wants to come to the table and work with us on these items, great. You know, we would always prefer, Nancy Pelosi would always prefer to get real solid legislation in. She can work on bipartisan compromises and so on and so forth. If not, this really becomes a political message because Democrats can say, hey, you've been saying on the campaign trail and in the White House that you want to work on these three things. We're passing legislation that does exactly that. Why are you not coming to the table? Why are Republicans not coming to the table? So over the next 2 years, as they try to prepare to win the Senate and the White House, I would expect that to be the exact message and these three things to be very high up on the congressional docket.
There have been complaints within the Democratic Party about kind of a generation gap in congressional leadership, the top three positions by held by older Democrats, not a lot of room for youth to advance in Congress. Is this a nod to those complaints?
Yes, I mean, certainly that these three members and another one, Ben Ray Lujan, and even further, Catherine Clark, who won the vice chairmanship role, advanced in the leadership elections. It does give some sense of relief to members who were worried that there's just really no next generation. There's nobody being primed for leadership. Well, these members certainly are, but that's not enough, and that's playing itself out as we speak here on the House side of the Capitol. Nancy Pelosi is trying to negotiate with a couple of rebels who are holding out support for her. And now the idea of term limits has come up. That's a very recent thing that, a lot of members have kind of been reluctant to go down that road, particularly because the Congressional Black Caucus is so dead set against it. They do not want to have to give up gavels held by Congressional Black Caucus members. But now Pelosi is almost at a point where she might not have a choice, that some members would just not support her unless she backs these kinds of provisions. So as a further effort to try to pacify some of these rebels, and even further than that, even people who support Pelosi, younger members, like you said, are just kind of looking for ways to advance, Pelosi might back this, and the caucus may vote on it early next year when when all of the new members come and join the members who were reelected and have their initial caucus meetings of the year.
Finally, I want to touch on this criminal justice reform bill. Senate Majority Mitch McConnell said, okay, he would bring this to the floor after being reluctant to. This is something backed by President Trump, among others. Broad strokes, what would this bill do?
Yeah, this is a nice, although modest, bipartisan compromise. It pertains only to federal prisoners, which is the smallest population of prisoners in this country. But it would ease things like the mandatory minimum sentences, three strikes, give judges more leniency in how to carry out sentences. It would give prisoners, federal prisoners, some good time credits, be able to lessen their sentences, or in some cases, if they're nonviolent offenders, even allow them to participate in education programs to limit recidivism, and then they could serve out some of their time, to finish their sentence in like a halfway house or in home confinement, things like that. That looks like it's on its way to passage. The House is ready to act on that whenever it finishes in the Senate, so they can close out the note on maybe a high note with some bipartisan legislation like the Farm Bill and criminal justice reform, and on a low note by shutting down part of the government.
Right. This is a packed agenda. Funding, Farm Bill, I guess, out of the way now. Criminal justice reform, I assume they're still approving judges here and there. I don't know. This is going to be a busy week and a half or so.
I mean, ain't it the way, they spend all year putting off the deadlines until the end of the year, hoping that when Christmas time comes around, members will smell the jet fumes and just want to pass things and get out of town. But it sometimes doesn't go quite the way that they planned it, and that's what's happening right now with the border wall and all the bickering that's going on between Republicans and Democrats.
Sounds like my educational career in a nutshell. Wait till the last minute on everything. Dan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
All right, anytime.
That's Dan Neuhauser, staff correspondent for the National Journal. He was with us for our weekly look at some of the top stories in national politics.
Coming up after the news, we'll hear about a program helping Wisconsin dairy farmers travel to Mexico to meet the families of their employees. I'm Darrell Connor.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Darrell Connor. The future of Wisconsin's legislative maps is a bit murkier with the elections of a Democratic governor and attorney general. Coming up, we'll look at the political and legal fights that lie ahead.
First, many of Wisconsin's dairy farms rely heavily on the labor of Mexican workers, and the language and cultural gap that creates can be difficult to bridge. But for the last 20 years, a group in Alma, Wisconsin has been working to change that.
The nonprofit organization Puentes, or Bridges in English, tries to build stronger connections by getting farmers to travel to the villages in Mexico where their workers grew up. The group also partners with UW Eau Claire to bring medical care directly to workers on farms.
Sean Duvall is the founder of Puentes. Sean, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
And Mercedes Falk is the current director of the group. Mercedes, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Well, Sean, can you tell us first how the idea for Puentes got started?
Well, way back in 97, 98, something like that, I was a Spanish teacher here in Alma, and our extension agent came to me and said, oh, there's a bunch of dairy farmers who are employing Mexicans. Don't you want to teach them some Spanish? And I thought, well, yeah, but you're not going to learn the Spanish you need in a 20-hour class. So I thought, well, maybe the better thing to do is take them to Mexico so they could learn a little bit about the culture and see why people are coming up here and leaving their homes to come up here to work for the opportunities that are presented to them here. So we partnered with a couple of dairy farms. We started some classes offering English and Spanish classes related to dairy. And then in 2001, we took our first trip And it's kind of been going since.
What was it like?
The idea was just, go ahead.
What was it like, Sean, when you first pitched a dairy farmer on this idea? Like, hey, let's take a field trip to your workers' hometowns down in Mexico.
Well, you'd probably have to ask John Rosenow that, but I thought it was a kind of a dumb idea until he went. And then all of a sudden, they understand exactly why the people come here. They get to meet their families. They get to meet their wives, their parents or their children. And that just sort of establishes that connection. And it fits so perfectly with the model of dairy farms as being family-owned businesses. It just seemed to work perfectly. And I think Mercedes can tell you, in all of the trips that we've taken so far, there's always someone that's just, it just changes how they see their employees, and also importantly changes how their employees see the employers. So it's really important.
And Mercedes, tell us a little bit more about what happens on one of these trips when dairy farmers from Wisconsin go down to Mexico.
Usually it is, they try to prepare themselves to think about what it might be like, but there's just no way to prepare themselves until they get down there. Usually they are just surprised and so moved by the hospitality of the families of the workers. They are just received so warmly. Everyone prepares them more than a huge feast and are just so honored that an employer would take the time to come all the way down to Mexico to visit the families of their son or brother or husband, whoever might be up here working.
And is there a lot of, trading stories about life in Wisconsin and life in Mexico?
Yes, definitely. There are a lot of similarities in between the life. Even though there are differences, there are similarities as far as living in a rural area and taking care of animals. So a lot of times the farmers get the chance to share how much the hard work of the employees has meant to the farmer and the farm. One of the guys that went down last year, he was able to share with the wife and father of his employee with him that he's been trained to breed cows, and that he had learned so well in this breeding of cows that he's better than the person that had been breeding cows on their farm for 10 years. And they just thought that was pretty funny and endearing that he was contributing so much to them.
Talking to Mercedes Falk and Sean Duvall from the group Puentes, which brings farmers in western Wisconsin mainly and part of Minnesota down to Mexico to visit the home villages, the homeland of a lot of the people working for them. Sean, I imagine there are some language gaps despite efforts to train both sides in Spanish on the one hand, English on the other. How do you help overcome that on these visits?
Well, another thing that both I have done, or I did, and Mercedes is doing now, as an aside and income generating, is we go to the dairy farms and interpret and do whatever is necessary to kind of bridge that relation gap while people are here. So, you know, we might have monthly meetings on a dairy farm to deal with issues to help, you know, the employers understand, well, why does Jose do things this way or vice versa? And those are also some of the little moments where, you know, you can inject that whole, our mission is to create understanding, and you can inject a lot of that understanding and help both sides, you know, have a better working relationship. So it's not just the trip. But it's also, you know, working on a daily basis to make a better relationship on the farm.
And Mercedes, another part of the work you're doing at Puentes is involves healthcare, bringing medical care in some cases to farms for workers. Can you tell us what happens?
Yeah, so it was a program that Sean helped spearhead with Lisa Schiller, who is a nursing professor at UW-Eau Claire. And once a semester, students come down and do health checkups and a little bit of education and just give the farmers the opportunity to meet with a nurse and kind of see where their health is and get some referrals to the free clinic up in Eau Claire.
And Sean, some of these workers may be undocumented workers. There's a lot, obviously, of rhetoric about immigrants, migrants, undocumented immigration. How do both sets of people, the farmers, the Wisconsin farmers and their employees, how do they talk about these issues?
Well, that's the difficult question. Of course, the dairy farmers do their due diligence as far as employing people, and they get the proper documents. And as a person who has worked on the farm, you know, it's really not my issue what the documentation status of people is. So you know, it's not a point. The point with Puentes is, you know, we are there to make a better relationship with employers and employees. And that's really the key as far as what we're doing. You know, we cannot, as a 501c3, we cannot be political, and we cannot take a political point of view. And so our that is just simply not our issue, I guess, is the easiest way. Don't you think, Mercedes?
Yes, that sounds exactly correct.
And Mercedes, as Sean had mentioned earlier, that part of the goal is to create understanding. And I think people who might follow immigration issues in the news might think of might have kind of a stock image of a farmer on the one hand, of a migrant worker on the other. Right. Are you seeing this help people see each other as people?
Yes, most definitely. Since I've had the opportunity to start this work, I just really see people have the opportunity and get the chance to get to know somebody more than just what they might be on a piece of paper. One thing that we are doing is telling stories on our Puentes website of farmers or people that live in our rural community and workers that have come up here. And we have just found that our stories are not too different. You know, we share similar hopes and dreams. And once people get the chance to know somebody who may look differently from them, they're not as hesitant because they realize that there are many more similarities than they would have thought.
And Sean, in the time you've been doing this, started back in the 90s, are you seeing the Wisconsin farmers keep in touch with the families of their workers who still live in Mexico, or maybe their workers who end up moving back to Mexico?
Oh, sure. There's many farmers who have gone down more than two or three times, and so they continually check in, or their friends on Facebook or WhatsApp, or you know, any number of now the wonderful ways that we have to communicate that they stay in touch with each other. Or family members will, you know, come up. They'll send a, you know, maybe a son or a daughter will come up and work on the farm where the father had worked a number of years ago, those kinds of things. So those connections do get established, and they stay. And it's really, really a beautiful thing to see.
And Mercedes, what are you looking for in the future for Puentes?
I'm hoping that we have the opportunity to keep taking trips to Mexico and keep being able to have people have the opportunity to know someone who might be different from them and to grow relationships and see that we share a lot more than we think.
Mercedes, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And Sean, thanks for being here.
You bet. Thanks so much.
That's Sean Duvall and Mercedes Falk from the nonprofit organization Puentes, a Wisconsin group that helps dairy farmers visit the families and hometowns of some of their Mexican employees. You can find out more at puentesbridges.org.
Coming up, state Republicans and Democrats are getting ready for a pretty serious fight over Wisconsin's legislative maps. We'll discuss how a new governor and attorney general may affect the future of redistricting. Coming up next on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Darrell Connor. Coming up, we'll talk about what's behind an outbreak in Legionnaires' disease in southeast Wisconsin and some of the ways to stop its spread.
First, new figures from the midterm elections and some number crunching by data wonks is putting Wisconsin's voting maps back in the spotlight.
The state recently posted results at the ward level. A couple of private analysts then used those numbers to calculate the vote for governor in each assembly district.
Even though Governor Walker lost to Tony Evers with about 49.5% of the vote, the analysis shows he carried 63 of the 99 assembly districts. And it shows that actually 64 districts are more Republican than the state as a whole, meaning the GOP has a built-in 29-seat advantage.
Democrats say that's proof that the maps are rigged. But Assembly Speaker Robin Voss disagrees, saying at least a dozen districts that Republicans won were also carried by Democratic U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin.
That's all likely to come up at an April trial for a federal lawsuit against Wisconsin's current maps. And with incoming Democrats taking over as governor and attorney general, what does the future hold for those legislative boundaries? Barry Burden is a professor of political science at UW-Madison and director of the UW's Elections Research Center. Barry, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Good afternoon.
Well, you've been watching these issues for a while. You've been looking at the November elections. How much does gerrymandering or gerrymandering, these partisan redistricting lines, how did that play out in the November elections?
Well, it was pretty stark in this year's elections. Democrats obviously had a good election season. In Wisconsin, they won all five of the statewide offices. That has not happened to Democrats since the mid-1980s. But their success really stopped when it came to the state legislature. There was just one seat that flipped in each chamber in opposite directions, so sort of canceling out. So next year's legislature is going to look very much like the current one, with Republicans in solid control of both the Assembly and the state Senate.
But is that inherently crooked or weird, or is it a fact, or is it a matter of, as some Republicans are pointing out, hey, a lot of the Democrats live in concentrated areas. Any map you're going to draw is going to have some kind of bias like that.
Both things are at work. So on the one hand, there is a kind of unintentional gerrymander that's due to where Democrats and Republicans are located around the state. Democrats are extremely concentrated in Madison and Milwaukee and a smaller number of cities around the rest of the state. So it's probably the case that almost any map that could be produced, even one that Democrats would produce, would be likely to show at least a slight advantage for Republicans on those grounds. But that natural advantage was exaggerated because Republicans drew the lines back in 2011, the ones we're still using today. And they executed a really efficient gerrymander where they packed Democrats into a smaller number of districts quite excessively, so they have far more votes than they need to elect someone, and then spread out their supporters in a pretty effective way so that they have solid majorities in many districts where they're winning in this year's elections by 55% to 60% in many districts.
One of the challenges for bringing this case to court has been, okay, how do you prove an excessively partisan gerrymandering effort? And there's this mathematical idea of wasted votes by packing, say, a lot of Democrats into a few districts. You end up wasting a lot of their votes. Are we able to start measuring that for what just happened in November yet?
We are, and I don't know the number that will come out of this year's elections, but I can tell you that that efficiency gap measure has been calculated for each of the last four cycles since the districts went into place, and that measure featured very prominently in the litigation, the Gill v. Whitford case that was decided here in Madison in the Western District Federal Court and then went to the U.S. Supreme Court. And in every election from 2012 till today, there's a very substantial advantage for Republicans. Many more Democratic voters have their votes wasted, either by being packed into districts so that they have many more than they would need to elect a Democrat, or put into districts where they're just below what they need to be effective, to, you know, often at something like 35, 40, 45% of the vote. So the combination of those two things, the packing of Democrats and the diluting of their votes in other districts, does push that efficiency gap measure sometimes in the direction of double-digit advantages for Republicans.
Now, this current map only gets used officially in one more legislative election in 2020 before the new map is supposed to get drawn. But this court case is still out there. The U.S. Supreme Court sent it back to a lower court. They didn't quite completely shoot it down. Where is that that case now?
Well, the case is being re-argued here in federal court. It will be a three-judge panel of federal judges in Madison. Two of them are part of the original three that heard the case a couple of years ago. I think the questions that will be at issue in the case are pretty much the same. The plaintiffs are arguing that Democrats have had their constitutional rights violated, First Amendment rights and 14th Amendment rights. The Supreme Court decided not to look at those arguments, mainly because they thought Democrats, at least the plaintiffs in the case, didn't have standing. The plaintiffs think they've fixed that because they now have the Democratic Party as a plaintiff and lots of voters around the state. But you're going to see all that evidence come back now into court. It'll be re-argued. I think the trial is set for April. Sometime after that, we'll get a decision, and then that case will again go to the Supreme Court for a look.
Talking to Barry Burden, professor of political science at UW-Madison, about Wisconsin's voting maps, past, present, and future. And now we don't know what the courts will end up doing with our current map. Let's turn to what happens next. The census 2020, we'll find out who lives where, and then what?
Yeah, isn't this an amazing irony? We're just about to enter a new redistricting season, and we're still arguing about the maps that were passed almost 10 years ago in the previous redistricting season. So every 10 years, the U.S. government does a census. That'll be done in 2020. The data from the census will be given to the state in the spring of 2021, so it's always a year that ends in one. Then the municipalities around the state will create wards for their council elections and supervisor elections. And then after that, normally the legislature would enact a law or try to do so that creates a new set of maps. The challenge next time will be that it looks like we'll have divided government with Tony Evers as governor and probably still Republicans in control of the legislature. That's actually a return to the way things used to work in Wisconsin. From the 1960s until 2011, it was always divided government, and there was always stalemate, and the legislature and governor could never produce an outcome they agreed on, and it always went to the courts, where the map was finally imposed on the state. So we're back to that kind of normal Wisconsin politics, which I think puts the 2011 districts, it kind of highlights their unusual nature, that this was done under a period of unified government, where Republicans, both in the governor's office and the legislature, adopted the maps. That has not been the pattern in Wisconsin just because parties have show off and shared power.
Now, in states around the country, I think both parties clearly get greedy. They hope they can control the whole process and draw a map their way. But there have been moves to change the redistricting process. Some other states do it differently. We've had calls in Wisconsin. At least one Democratic lawmaker is going to reintroduce a bill to have an independent entity draw the state's legislative maps. What are other ways we could do this apart from either one side does it all or both sides disagree and end up in the courts?
Well, there are now a lot of different models out there. This is one of the reforms that's moving across the states pretty quickly. States are adopting, in many cases, either a bipartisan commission or a tripartisan commission that has some independence on it. Just in this year's elections, I think there were four states where voters passed a referendum to create a commission in places like Michigan and Utah and elsewhere. In most of those states, there's a citizens commission where regular people can apply to serve. It will have a certain number of Republicans, a certain number of Democrats, and then usually either one independent tiebreaker or several. And the commission will have to come up with maps, and by a supermajority vote, pretty near consensus, can impose those maps. The other model besides these citizens commissions that gets a lot of interest is what Iowa does, sometimes called the Iowa model. There, it's a state agency that draws the maps, and they hand them to the state legislature, which has to vote for them up or down with really no change. So you don't have citizens involved. There's really no partisan politics. That system has worked pretty well in Iowa since 1980, and I know that's one model that Wisconsin legislators sometimes look to.
Now, we've had funky maps in the United States going back to when a guy named Gary drew this salamander-shaped district and got made fun of, and probably before that. But is it bad for representative government to have these lines? How does it hurt us?
Well, it's complicated. It actually does put people into more homogeneous districts. So today, more Democrats in Wisconsin are represented by Democrats and Republicans by Republicans. So there's a better match, maybe, between the party of the legislator and of the constituent. But what it has done on the negative side is to essentially make control of the legislature uncompetitive. Even though the vote in Wisconsin sometimes favors Democrats in a statewide election, sometimes Republicans, we've had waves of both kinds in recent years, the legislature is impervious to that. It doesn't change. Again, these last four election cycles from 2012 till now, Republicans have had something between 60 and 65 of the seats in the assembly, despite the fact that Obama won the state one year, that this year was a good year for Democrats. So it essentially weakens the responsiveness of the legislature to actual changes in public preferences among voters.
With divided state government coming up, as you were saying, how ugly do you think this redistricting issue could get in 2021?
I think it could be quite ugly. Even in the Supreme Court case, it's going to be handled before that. There are going to be attorneys side by side. One will be the attorney general representing the state. The other will be an attorney appointed by Republicans in the assembly. So even that process will be contentious, but then when it comes to actually producing the maps in 2021, if we still have divided government, my guess is this goes very quickly to some litigation and to some courts being involved.
Very briefly, is this something that people in the public could get riled up enough about to make a difference and actually make Wisconsin change to something like maybe the Iowa model?
It is interesting. The amount of attention that the public pays to this issue has definitely risen over the last decade. It's now something you hear people talk about, among other issues, so that they care about jobs and taxes and immigration and health care, and also campaign finance and redistricting. Those both come up now as real concerns. The trouble is it's also become a partisan issue. And at least in Wisconsin, Democrats have sort of come around to the idea. They initially resisted it when they were in power. Being out of power makes it much more attractive. Republicans in the legislature seem very much opposed to the idea, so I don't see a lot of compromise there. And unlike these other states where it's been adopted by voters in a ballot initiative or referendum, Wisconsin doesn't have that option. So I think we're stuck with the system we have, at least for the near term.
Barry, thanks a lot for joining us.
Glad to be here.
That's Barry Burden, professor of political science at UW-Madison, director of the UW's Elections Research Center, talking to us about Wisconsin's upcoming redistricting fight. Do you have plans to make some holiday cookies? Well, don't eat the dough. That's the message from the CDC this month. And it's not just about the raw eggs. That's what I would have thought. They say the uncooked flour can carry potentially hazardous bacteria. Darrell, do you now or have you ever eaten cookie dough?
Oh, yeah. Back in the day, there used to be a product called Mrs. Good Cookie, and it was in a paper pan. But the difference between that and the Pillsbury was that they were in oval pieces. So you can break them off and eat them that way. So that's what I used to do. And then for some reason, they stopped making them. So I had to go to the Pillsbury.
Maybe some kind of litigation
style.
Involved. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. And but yeah, I did. I ate it a lot.
I ate them as a kid if my mom was making cookies. And there was a point in my life where my roommate and I would make a full batch of chocolate chip cookie dough and mm-hmm. not make a cookie. We'd eat the whole batch over the course of a couple of days. Not my best health decision, I'll admit.
I think there's lots of people who did that, though.
Now, despite the CDC warning, I mean, so you hear this now. It's not just eggs you got to worry about and the salmonella. The flour can maybe carry E. coli, they say, if it's uncooked. Is this going to deter you from eating cookie dough in the future?
Well, I haven't done it in years.
Okay.
But I don't think it will. I mean, I'm 50 years old. It hasn't killed me yet.
All right. But you're not going to seek out raw cookie dough just to eat it.
No.
Yeah, I'm kind of off the cookie dough, too. And I try to keep my kids from eating it. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.